Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 86. Biomasses for the masses.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. Are you ready? I didn't go 3, 2, 1. Okay, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. The mission of Futures in Biotech has been to bring a firsthand account of great science and engineering that's going on today in hopes to get a glimpse of what our future holds. Our guests provide a great example of technical innovation and transformation, and they may just transform an industry. I'd like to welcome John Griswold, President and CEO of Alloterra Energy. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
And I'm doing some switching here, so it's going to be a little slow. Welcome, John. Also, we have his son, Matthew Griswold, who's Chief Financial Officer of Alloterra Energy. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you very much.
And we also have Mark Griswold, who's been on the show. Is this your fourth time or fifth?
Somewhere in there. I think it's the fourth.
Right. So we've covered MRI. We've covered, you've helped with some engineering physics shows. And, you know, clearly the apple didn't fall far from the tree. And I can see where you get your innovative mind and your science mind. So with, you know, the first questions I'd like to start to ask your father. And so John, let's start talking about energy. So you, the business that you've been running for about 12 years called Griswold Energy Partners, maybe you could tell us a little bit about that company and then how it sort of, you know, to get us, give us a footprint as to what the current, you know, business model is for that form of energy and how you, and that could lead us on to a transition into your current new company.
Mm-hmm. Well, for almost 20 years now, we've been involved with gasoline, diesel fuel, and the distribution of those fuels up through the pipeline and primarily to unbranded gasoline and diesel fuel supplies. So we are kind of a buying arm for these companies, and a few years ago we recognized the need for ethanol in the Mid-South, and ethanol was pretty well log jammed within the Midwest. Ohio, Iowa, Illinois had plenty of supplies, plenty of infrastructure. And a few years back we recognized the need for movement of ethanol out of the Midwest, and so we built a bunch of terminals across the Mid-South and the South to help the distribution effort of the ethanol producers. From that, we started to look at the cap that was being placed on corn, that only so much corn could go into ethanol. And we recognize that this country's got to get after a better energy source than corn for ethanol. And if you look at Brazil and how they've handled their crude and their ethanol requirements, it was clear that ethanol can be used as a primary fuel. And so we began exploring how this country is going to move from a corn-based ethanol to a cellulosic ethanol. And that led us into this grass, a biograss called miscanthus, that is being planted almost all over Europe and being burned.
So you saw sort of a, you were in an industry that was moving fuel, you know, chemical fuel, chemical energy, from the south, from Texas up to the Midwest.
Correct.
And then you branched that out into ethanol as well, in pipelines as well?
No, they all have to move by rail. Ethanol cannot move within the pipelines. So we would build terminals that would take rail cars from the Midwest to the south and offload them and put them in the terminals in the south.
Wow. So I do have a few quick questions about the oil, the process of shipping oil as well, because this gives us a sense of the infrastructure that already exists for energy. We were talking and you were saying that you can pipe millions of gallons per minute.
Per minute.
So yeah. It's basically a river, a huge river.
Yes.
Of oil from Texas all the way to Chicago, for example.
All the way to Chicago, all the way to New York City. It mostly stays in the Midwest. Houston fuel stays in the Midwest to the east, the east coast.
Sort of
it doesn't go
corridor.
West. Does not go west very well.
And I guess the pipelines would have to go up and then down. That would be costly in terms of pumping them up and down. Or is there other, they've got ships?
Well, California has, and Utah has quite a few refineries out that way. And there's small pipelines that run within states, a few states, and that's it. Whereas you got the Colonial Pipeline that runs through many, many states on its way to New York.
So it's gas and diesel or oil and diesel that you worked with?
Oh, for us, it was always refined fuels, gasoline, diesel fuel, and the various grades of those.
So if somebody was in Chicago, they had a business, they had a station, they wanted to order, what's the size of the order for a week? Do they order by the week or by the day?
They order by quantity.
By quantity.
And usually it's a million gallons every time.
Wow. So one small service station can...
No, not one. It takes probably 10 or so service stations to equal a million gallons a month.
For an order.
Yeah.
And then they have co-ops and they split it up. Wow. And so how much does it cost to move a gallon of gasoline from Texas all the way to Chicago?
Oddly enough, it only takes 2 or 3 cents.
Which is amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, my argument with respect to, oil development in Alaska versus maybe hydroelectricity in Alaska to ship to continental USA has been the argument that if you ever carried a bucket of water, it's really, really heavy, right? Mm-hmm. And what a pain. So the thought that the infrastructure is there that can do that for so cheap, cents, pennies to the gallon.
Just a few, yeah.
That's stunning.
Depends on the location. I mean, about the highest one I can think of is maybe 5-6 cents, no more than that, anywhere in the country.
Right. So carrying electricity might just be more expensive with respect to infrastructure than carrying oil.
Maybe.
we'd have to find out about the electricity. But that's amazing. So America has an infrastructure for oil.
Oh, a very good one, yeah.
I guess we just need to find more sources here for independence or alternatives to oil that have a light infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So you were working on, moving oil and gasoline and diesel, refined fuels, across the United States and helping companies move it around and buy it and sell it. And then you found the opportunity to move ethanol, and then there was those limitations to how much could be produced by corn.
Oh, there are. It's right. Mandated. It's a government mandate.
And why is there a mandate to limit the amount of ethanol produced by corn?
The food for fuel, for one. Matt, you got any more thoughts there?
Yeah, the reason why it's limited is not... it's not quite in quantity. It's limited by the amount of incentives that the government provides for additional corn ethanol that's being made. So we're essentially there right now. Maybe next year we'll be right at that level that it wouldn't make sense to produce ethanol anymore from corn. So that's why we realize we're up against a wall. There's not going to be any more corn that is going to be put into the corn ethanol that's going to be put into the system. So what's next? And that's what led us to look at miscanthus and how we can utilize this grass to help us with that need to go from 15 billion gallons annually to 36 billion gallons annually. That's what the goal of this country is by 2022, I believe the number is. So it's a big leap.
So how did this, it come about? All of a sudden you had an idea. You said, we've got to find an alternative. Let's find an alternative to corn to produce ethanol. And that was the goal of forming Alotero Energy. Was it to produce ethanol or to produce an alternative to ethanol?
Well, that led us to miscanthus. But it wasn't specifically for us generating ethanol. We determined there was no movement in this country towards finding this cellulosic base, and most of the other cellulosic things that we'd picked up really economically don't meet the grade. So we've begun to grow miscanthus to show that it can be done in this country, just like it's being done in Europe. And eventually, once we get a feedstock built, I mean, enough acres built, then the ethanol people should look at us a lot closer.
So miscanthus is a grass?
A grass, just...
And it has more cellulose in it or an easily refined cellulose versus other grasses or corn stalk?
Oh, it's not easier. No, it's cellulosic ethanol is hard to process.
Okay. So you don't use a bioreactor. You would that would be chemically produced. Oh, you'd have to use a bioreactor to turn it to ethanol.
Yeah, I mean you would use that, but the problem with the miscanthus is that its sugars are bound much more tightly than the way they are in corn. You know, you can ferment corn rather easily using technology that's hundreds of years old. You can't do that with miscanthus or other types of more woody type biomass. So it takes something to break those bonds first to then be able to access the sugars to ferment it into ethanol. So it's somewhat a much more difficult process.
The gut of a cow, right?
You got it. Yeah.
You need stones. You need a gizzard. You need to really grind it up. So, and then throw in a bunch of expensive enzymes. But there's, you know, so I don't know. Would this be a good time to show the video that you have on YouTube to sort of give people a picture of what we're talking about here? Because, let's go for it.
After 2 years of growth, this field of miscanthus near Haven, Kansas is now ready to be harvested. Quickly, you can see the high mass and thick volume of the crop that can produce baled tonnage above 10 tons per acre with low moisture readings. Miscanthus is typically planted in early spring before most row crops like corn and soybeans are planted. The winter after its second growing season, the miscanthus will be ready for harvest. This harvest will typically take place from December to early March whenever field conditions warrant. Both the initial planting and the subsequent annual harvest complement the existing crop cycle on most farming operations today. The bulk of the harvest uses equipment that is standard for a large hay or forage operation. AGCO has developed a special cutting head for their swather that develops lush windrows, which are immediately ready for baling. Although the crop is tall and thick, the available technology from AGCO can cut the miscanthus fast and efficiently. In fact, this two-year-old field was cut at a 9-acre-per-hour pace. In no time at all, you are set up to bale up the windrows. As the baler goes to work, you can see the sheer mass of the yield that is baled up. At a pace of 2 acres per hour, the baler produces 28 1,400-pound bales every hour. That's 20 tons per hour. As harvesting continues, driving over the cane stubble will not cause any additional wear and tear on your equipment's tires. Like with any crop that is baled, moisture readings are important. Although some additional mass is lost by allowing the crop to remain in the field until late winter, the resulting baled biomass has a very low moisture reading right out of the field.
There's the temperature, and there's the moisture.
You can see that this miscanthus has a moisture reading of 14.5 just seconds after it is baled. Due partly to its perennial nature, miscanthus needs less fertilizer than traditional row crops. The first freeze causes the miscanthus plant to pull the nutrients up from the cane and leaves into its root system. This process makes miscanthus very efficient at processing nitrogen. Additionally, carbon is sequestered in the soil through the process. There you have it. The available ease and efficiency to harvest miscanthus is here and now. Be a part of this growing bioenergy trend by doing what you already know how and are equipped to do. The need for alternative energy sources is growing. Where do you want to stake your future? The future of our country is once again in your hands. Together, we can make a difference.
You look at the grass and it certainly makes you feel like a Smurf, right? Because that's huge, huge grass. Maybe you could walk us through the process. What should we cover? Should we cover, you know, there's different angles here. And this is an enormous biomass. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at converting it to fuel. When you're making that decision for your business, right, you could have – why did you go into growing a new biomass – as opposed to finding models to business models to work with, delivering energy. I mean, what was the driving force? Is this a long-term goal of yours, mm-hmm. sort of a mission to innovate and create a new source of energy for America?
Is it? Yes, we think America has to do something to. And one of the most highly unutilized resources this country has is farmland. There is a tremendous amount of farmland that sits around and it's idle, not being used. Actually, a lot of ground is in what's called a CRP program, and the government actually pays to keep that ground idle. Whereas this grass, it doesn't require real good soil. It really does well on marginal ground. And it's a perennial. It comes back year after year. So you don't add lots of fertilizers and herbicides and insecticides. It is a very tough plant that comes back year after year.
It looks almost like 20 years. Giant weed.
No, you can see it in, there's a lot of yards today, if you noticed, it's an ornamental grass. People use it in their landscaping all the time. It's real tall.
Well, I guess when I say weed, I think a robust plant that can grow with, you know, fairly harsh conditions and yet still produce that incredible density.
It is very hardy. It'll tolerate a lot of cold weather. It'll tolerate a lot of water, and it's also pretty drought resistant. It doesn't do well in the southern parts of the U.S. There's no frost down there, and the rainfall. It does need some rainfall to keep it going. In the Midwest is perfect. Ohio is very perfect. That's why we're up here.
Wow. So how many million acres would you need to produce enough energy? What are the numbers, basically, if you were to put acreage into some kind of megawatt equivalent of from a coal-burning plant?
Oh, boy.
He's the CFA.
I'll try to help here.
Is that how you calculate?
Well, kind of, yeah. And I guess I should also point out here while we're kind of talking about, coal and doing some sort of conversion that would be equivalent. You know, we started out with miscanthus looking at ethanol. That's how we got to where we are today with this crop. But honestly, we're looking at a number of different avenues for this product. And it's really, when you think about it, we're growing a fiber. And fibers have a lot of uses throughout the economy. Fuel is one of them. It's probably the largest market for a product such as this. But there's lots of other things, you know, consumer products, potential chemicals, several different avenues that we're investigating right now. But your largest volume is going to be fuel of some sort. So just to give you an idea of, and we can do some quick comparisons, a BTU of miscanthus is about 15, for a ton of miscanthus, is about 15 million BTUs. A ton of coal is about 25 million BTUs. A acre of farmland will generally produce 12 to 15 tons of miscanthus, and that's a dry weight. So let me just do that calculation real quick here. Just saying tons, 12 tons an acre at 15 million BTUs. That's 180 million BTUs per acre that can be grown. Now I could do some quick calculations to put it back into a megawatt. I think the numbers roughly work out to be about 100 tons of biomass equals a megawatt, depending upon the efficiency of the turbine that you're using. So just to give you some scale there to kind of figure it out, it would be literally in the millions of acres to, you know, start generating megawatts that that make a significant impact, and we can get there. There's enough of those acres laying around throughout the country to make that happen.
So Mark, let me just break in here if I could. So
yeah,
just
sure.
I try to always bring this back to real life things. That's 7 tons of coal that you're taking out of the normal energy stream per acre of miscanthus. And this stuff is going to grow back every year, while that coal that they're digging out of the mountains in West Virginia is a one-time only thing. And so you've got two components here that are, you know, working in our favor. First, the stuff grows back every year, so it's a renewable thing. And second, it's carbon neutral. So whatever carbon is getting put into those fibers came from the air. That coal that we're burning from the mountains in West Virginia is, you know, only going to increase our whole climate change problem. And so even if this isn't the most efficient thing in the world, it's still, you know, pushing things in the right direction.
Are you sure it's carbon neutral?
Well, what are the inputs? There's the inputs to plant it, which costs, I agree.
Right.
It needs very, very little fertilizer. You could go with next to nothing for a very long period of time. And so, you know, if I compare it to corn, for example.
Right. I'm just joshing with you. You look at a plant, you're growing it, right? Where do the roots go?
The roots stay there.
They stay in the ground. So what happens to all that carbon?
It stays there. It
stays fixed, right? So it's actually carbon negative. I got that from your dad.
Yeah.
So you're actually taking CO2 out of the air and sticking it in the ground. You're reversing that whole process.
Sure.
So
yeah. you're at least putting it in the right direction. So even, I guess for me, it's even if it isn't the most efficient mechanism to do it, it still is infinitely better than burning coal or burning oil, no matter how you look at it.
Right. So we have a CFA, right? So the numbers for extracting coal, I mean, we just talked about the numbers for moving oil and, or sorry, gasoline and diesel at pennies per gallon from Houston or from Texas to Chicago. Are the numbers there to drive an industry into saying, uh-oh, wait a minute, I'm losing money by not doing this?
Yeah, and they're getting there. You know, you need to have economies of scale to make any project work that's involved in energy. So we're getting there. You know, the 20,000 acres that we're going to be planting next spring is going to be a huge leap in energy crops in this country. And I would say that at that point, we will have the most energy crops of anyone in the country. That right there helps us determine what path to take. And this is not going to be a distribution system to take fuel made in Houston, for instance, and run it up a pipeline all the way to New York. It's not going to be that way. It's going to be more of a medium to large scale distributed production. So, for instance, in our Northeast Ohio project centered around Ashtabula County, that biomass, it is our hope, will not leave that general area. You know, it may get into Cleveland a little bit, maybe go down to Pittsburgh, Youngstown, but for the most part, it's going to stay local, which cuts down on transportation, cuts down on your carbon footprint, and that's really where it's needed. And that applies to if you're going to make pellets for heat and electricity, some sort of consumer products, some sort of chemicals. There's enough industry around there to take and use that product locally. And the same goes for the other project areas that we're involved with in Missouri and Arkansas. I'll give you a real specific example here. I've got the numbers up on my other screen. In our Southwest Missouri project, where we're partnered with MFA Oil, which is a one of the largest co-ops in the country, and they cover 40,000 farmer members in Missouri. That particular area of Missouri down in the southwest corner, there's a lot of chickens that are grown in that area. And propane is a large expense for them as they heat their chicken houses throughout the winter. And I got one example here that I've pulled up. One of these places may use about 3 million gallons of propane in a year. And propane furnaces typically have about a 90% efficiency. If you replaced it with a biomass furnace, which is typically about 80% efficient, and you generated 12 tons an acre in that area, which we think is certainly doable, 12 tons per acre of miscanthus, you would need to plant about 1,700 acres to replace that 3 million gallons of propane. And that would be at a cost savings of about 50% relative to current propane prices. So it's pretty significant, and it's all local. It's not bringing anything from the outside of that area to generate that industry. It's grown and used right there.
We had up in Canada, back in 89, there was this big a power outage because of the aurora borealis. And, you know, a lot of, you know, non-scientists said, oh, you guys are nuts. It's not the aurora borealis. But what happened is we have hydroelectric wires up there that go for 2,000 miles from James Bay and Hudson Bay all the way down to Montreal. And you have a mass of protons, 30 times the mass of the Earth. The Earth flies right through it and ducks current. Or was it, what's the law, Mark, Faraday's law?
That's Faraday's law, yep.
Yeah, so inducing current into these lines, and then boom, everybody's out of power. So my father, and this was after hydroelectricity became the infrastructure for the province. People realized that those subsidized stove furnaces in their houses that were electric were no, you know, they were vulnerable. And when it gets to minus 50 out, you look for a second source of power in the house as an alternative. And we put in a biofuel burning stove in our fireplace. Back in 89, 90. And so I can see this great need for heating, certainly north of the border, and, you know, a lot of northern states could really, you know, benefit from this. But I have to say, though, most Canadians would, you know, would be upset at the lack of CO2 emissions because they're all praying for global warming. And if there's a chance that it's connected, they've got like prayers that aren't going to be answered. I guess the far north, they don't like it because the permafrost is melting and their houses are collapsing, but that's another story. So this is really, really neat. You could literally cut the cost of fuel, make it a local fuel, and use it in industrial settings like chicken farming.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And one additional benefit is the prices get more stable. You won't see big price fluctuations based on a speculative futures crude oil market. This is going to be an ag-based, much more stable.
Would it use the same sort of central market? In terms of oil, does oil come in, the refineries pool it together, they refine it, they pool it, and then people bid on the price? Or, you know, is that how it works for oil?
It's a combination of the refiner saying, this is what I got to have, and the end user saying, this is how much I'll pay. And that goes on every minute of the day and night.
So each farmer could produce a crop, know what his costs are, and give the mm-hmm. traditional markup for the business.
And the chicken guy will buy this stuff for a year or two out. If you can guarantee him a price, he can guarantee his margin. And the same way with the hog guy, the same way with the greenhouse who needs heat, it stabilizes everything price-wise.
Could you burn this on a large scale, like as in coal, or is this only work on medium and small size furnaces? Could you basically revamp the coal plants that are just down the street on the Lake Erie? Mm-hmm.
There's been a big move that's kind of been it's kind of went to sleep, but there was a lot of desire to mix maybe a 10% or 20% blend of coal with this type of product, and reduce their emissions sharply. But that's kind of went to the sidelines, right, Matt? In the last few days, weeks.
Yeah, and I think coal replacement is hard right now. There are some regulations out there that are forcing some of the coal companies in Ohio, for instance, is an example. They've got to produce 20% of their energy from renewable sources by 2025, I believe. That's when that has to kick in. And some of the facilities are already moving in that direction. But honestly, they're having trouble finding viable sources. The only substantial amount of biomass that exists in this country today is from wood. That is not nearly as renewable as miscanthus or another type of dedicated energy crop is. You know, even if you sustainably harvest a forest, it takes 10 to 15 years for that forest to get back to its original state. So it's really a problem of supply. And that's why these project areas that we're going to be planting for next spring are critical. Because once that supply is there, some of these companies will feel a lot more comfortable about meeting these goals. So that's what we hope happens.
You know, if everybody goes on to Google right now, or if when they get a chance, go look in north of Quebec City, about 200 miles, and zoom in at high res. There is millions and millions and millions of acres of clear cuts, right? And the funny thing is they don't clear cut along the road. They leave maybe 30 to 50 feet of trees along the road. So you think you're driving in a forest. And every so often you get a crack in the trees and then you look, and then it's Mars, right? Mm-hmm. And that's mostly for pulp and paper. And so you were mentioning other products as well. I'm like kind of all over the place here because this is not my field, but I think it's an incredible story that we need to build on this biomass production thing. But so pulp and paper, can you make paper out of the cellulose from these? Has it been done yet?
Oh yeah, we are currently working on that, and we got people very close to putting it out there for us. You can make paper, you can make biodegradable products, trays and things like that, get rid of the styrofoam issue. We would prefer to push for more biodegradable type consumer products. And there's a list, an enormous list of them that this can be put into. It does make great paper. a writing paper.
So, you know, you could imagine, I guess the New York Times is becoming paperless. The publishing industry is going paperless. And I have to admit, I don't buy paper anymore, but I get all my news. But, you know, I'm still going to go to McDonald's and buy four mm-hmm. drinks for the family. And it's going to be held in a cardboard cup. Mm-hmm. We have tons and tons of cardboard boxes outside. Yeah. It's an integral part to our to industry and moving mm-hmm. forward. We need paper products. Mm-hmm. So that's really cool that this crazy grass can...
Actually, we view Miss Kansas as much like corn and beans have been. You know, you started out with corn and you just used it for feed. Now what you see is corn's being broke down into all its parts, starch and sugars and all kinds of things. And beans are made from protein and you see it in bean oil and all kinds of different things. Miss Kansas has exactly the same characteristics. When you break down a bale of Miss Kansas, there are all kinds of parts in there.
What about the idea that, well, ethanol, you're growing, there's that limitation of food for crops. Mm-hmm. Don't you still have that same situation where if you're growing Miss Kansas, you're not growing food? I mean, does it compete for food?
No, this is usually put on ground that isn't currently in production of corn and beans. This is ground, and you see it all over Ohio, particularly here in Ohio, where there is lots of idle acres just sitting there. It's not been used for years and years. It needs to be put back into production. This country has an asset that they're not using.
Hey, Mark, can I jump in here as well, too? There's a kind of a surprising point that I never would have guessed before getting involved in this, and that is that 85% or something along the lines of 85% of the corn that's grown isn't going towards food. It's either going towards ethanol or going towards animal feeds and things like this. And so if you could come up with a way... You know, we were joking earlier, you know, that you could feed the cow this miscanthus. You know, if you could come up with a mechanism to do that, not only would you, you know, get rid of all the carbon, you could potentially get rid of a lot of that farmland that's being used to just feed cows and pigs, and do it much more efficiently with a renewable crop that grows back every year instead of having to replant corn and replant all that stuff every year. Just plant this stuff once and do it in an efficient way. The thing that's missing, and this is where the biotech audience is important, is just what are those processes that are going to be needed to break this stuff down to make it into that animal feed or to convert it to as efficiently as possible to ethanol. But the potential here is near infinite. Well, it's just so much more efficient.
You could, I mean, basically cellulases. You need things that can digest cellulose and turn it into glucose. And the brand, you can think of cellulose as a polymer, much like glycogen in your muscle tissue. It's a polymer of sugars. And you can break this down to sugars of various lengths. So you can have a disaccharide, trisaccharides, you know. Right. So with the correct enzymes, but you don't necessarily need to purify those enzymes. You could have crude bioreactors of bugs that are overexpressing those enzymes, secreting them into the liquid, and just
absolutely,
you know, that'd be pretty cheap because they'd be feeding themselves on cellulose, growing to a biomass, and then overproducing one specific protein, and hence creating this giant bioreactor of sugar, which then could ferment, produce ethanol, and produce other kinds of food products. But the sugar alone would be a great source of food for livestock.
Yeah. So there's a guy that everybody should go look at who's worried about the food versus energy conflict. And it's Bruce Dale is the guy's name at Michigan State. He runs a group, everythingbiomass.org, I think is the link. And he can pretty, if you look at his information there, pretty conclusively debunks this conflict that's put up there. Just to be clear, I think and again, this isn't the political me speaking, I think that conflict is pushed in there every time when we, you know, from the oil and the gas industry that's out there, because they don't want to change. And
you guys do. That's well, the point. That's the right. great part of this story, right? This is the Griswold right. family gas and diesel business transforming into a biofuels business because of incredible opportunity, right?
Yeah, but it's all it goes beyond that. It doesn't have to be the most efficient thing for us to move in the what should be the right direction. You know, every time that we invest in oil and gas, it's a dead end technology. It cannot last forever. And so we've got to start moving to these more efficient, more renewable type things, even if it costs more in the beginning. You know, the initial cost can't be the limiting factor. And there's going to, and again, the biotech stuff downstream, this is going to have huge impact. I know, you know, we both do medicine. It's going to have impact too. But energy is something that every one of us need. And if we don't fix this, we're going to run into big problems.
Seriously, you could probably get some undergraduates design a bug to process this. I mean, it's not that big a deal anymore to engineer either yeast or even E. coli or algae to process miscanthus cellulose into anything. There could be some mechanics involved, some engineering to break it down into chewable parts, into a slurry that then can be turned into a food for critters. I bet half the audience of Futures in Biotech could turn this stuff into whatever ethanol or sugar, whatever you want. We can do it. And we, you know, maybe we, that's something we could talk about off at the air and a fun proposal. But so there's a couple of things that I'm wondering about. How does miscanthus as a biomass compare to other source of renewable biofuels? And for example, how does it compare to solar? Okay, let's start with solar. How does it compare? How does producing a biomass compare to solar panel in terms of energy use and energy production and energy delivery? How does solar and bio compare?
Matt, are you taking that?
Yeah, that is a pretty tough question there, Mark. What's the efficiency on a solar panel these days? 17%, 18%? Is it significantly more than that?
For a commercial one, that's it. There's new ones coming up which are 50. But
I'm just wondering, in terms of energy use and energy consumption profiles, right, of industry, can solar power produce energy into the grid in a way that's more stable than biomass production, right? For biomass, you're taking the sun's energy, fixing carbon from the atmosphere, using a few nutrients from the soil, and producing a compound, a chemical that can be stored for years. It could be stored for 20 years, 50 years. You could create huge, giant reserves. Whereas solar power, you could store it for a day, maybe, if you have giant batteries, but it has to feed a grid and be consumed immediately, right? Does that affect the market for biomass versus alternative sources like solar and wind?
Yeah, I think they all play a part, but it's a different game. You know, I don't see us competing with solar and wind. There's a lot of solar panels in Ohio, actually, but it's probably not the most efficient place to put.
It's cloudy right now.
Yeah,
it will be.
So it's kind of hard to. There's a place for solar panels. There's a place for biomass. There's a place for wind. They all play a part. Wind only blows part of the time. It's sunny only half or less of the time. Biomass, maybe you could think of that as your solar battery. You know, you're taking energy from the sun, making biomass, and that biomass doesn't go bad the minute it's produced. It can be stored. It can be densified. Not hugely efficient from that standpoint, but it complements the other sources. You know, and the carbon aspect of that I think is important too. You know, we've talked about that a little bit. You know, but that shouldn't be. You know, a lot of our conversations with people out in the industry, we really just don't even talk about it because there's no economic value right now for carbon credits. But it's just such a huge part of the picture longer term when you view what we're doing. So I don't know. I don't have any specific numbers on how biomass compares with solar. I can tell you that miscanthus relative to other energy crops such as switchgrass, which is one that people talk about quite a bit, it's quite a bit more efficient. You know, you're talking 4 to 6 tons an acre for switchgrass, and you know, 12 to 15 tons per acre for miscanthus. That's a big difference. It's more difficult to plant miscanthus than it is switchgrass, but your benefits longer term outweigh the those initial costs. So, and we're one of our efforts here is to bring those initial costs down to the point where it's as if you're planting corn, or maybe just a little bit more expensive. So we're getting there. So we're pretty well convinced that miscanthus is the best biomass crop out there, and I would think we'll need all of these sources to really make a go of this energy independence in this country.
How does miscanthus compare to, you know, when I look at some of the concepts, you know, I'm in a biotech industry and I see biofuels companies coming up with some serious biotech. And you know, the way I see science done, right? Sometimes you could take a neuron and put it into a physiological buffer and then get it to synapse, right? And you're getting these electrical pulses going, and then you do an elegant experiment with it lasts 24 hours. Then you realize that the data is crappy, right, overall. Whereas if you did the experiment in 30 seconds, the data produced from this neuron might be clean and accurate. And I see the, you know, the biofuels industry producing, for example, George Church, who we've had on as a guest, who's one of the world's leading geneticists, is leading a team that's developing, I think it's an E. coli carrying a series of algae genes to fix atmospheric CO2 and photosynthesize. So he's taking a bacteria, easy to grow, and they're talking about having the E. coli basically secrete, you know, basically gasoline, you know, polymers of oil that are what, 8 to 10 chain. I'm not that familiar with the structure of gasoline, but it's a refined lipid polymer, lipids of what, 8 to 10. Octane is 8. You know, how is it, what's higher than octane? Do you have longer chains, Mark? You're the chemist here.
Yeah. Suddenly, yeah, I'm so, a chemist.
You're the one who studied college chemistry. So I took it in French, so I'm my nomenclature is horrible. But basically, the point is, you could have critters, bugs, producing, fixing atmosphere and producing oil and gasoline directly, but and creating some of these large bioreactor vats that are photosynthesizing. You know, my point is, I'm talking about complicated experiments to achieve a goal, where something as simple as, you know, technically simple as planting grass in land that is not that fertile anymore. Okay, so this brings me to the point. You guys bought an Amish farm in rural Ohio. You had no power going to the house.
No,
you
know? Power. No.
Nothing.
No phone.
No phone.
No. Zero.
Zero. Did you have plumbing?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So how many acres was it?
Right at 100. Okay. Just short of 100.
Short of 100. So you have about 100 acres. There's a house with no power.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like that movie with Harrison Ford, where he discovers this new way of thinking, a new way of life that's rustic and very, you know, 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And you turn this into a modern, a farm that's producing a modern, or solving a modern limitation to society, right? Socioeconomic problem is this lack of energy, or this constant demand for energy.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about buying that farm in Ashtabula. Why did you pick that farm?
Well, it's it had the potential for wind, and it had plenty of water. It's got a creek running down. It's a very attractive place, and it had some flat fields to it as well. So it was so positioned so well for us, because Ashtabula County is the largest hay growing county in Ohio, and it's that way because it gets a lot of moisture. That lots of moisture is up there year after year, and that's what we wanted to get with miscanthus. We don't want to irrigate this stuff all the time, so we located there. And up there, you've got a real good rail, truck, port, all of it way underutilized, So we all the elements were there that we wanted, and particularly the rainfall. And that's a very wet area.
Well, it gets a lake effect, right?
Yes.
So all these, there's like 400 miles of Lake Erie in length. Right. Mm-hmm. All of the south shore of that gets lake effect, and Lake Ontario, and then Michigan. Well, mm-hmm. Michigan's, I guess, not so great a wheat producer. It's more of a forest setting. But what about the winter? You harvest this, it said in the video, you harvest it in February, March?
Throughout the lower part of the Midwest, yes, that's what we'll do it.
Okay.
Whenever the ground freezes, we can cut this stuff off. Share with you, it's growing season is as soon as the ground reaches 50 degrees, it's growing. And that's right about the time when farmers are planting corn. But it doesn't shut down until the first frost. So it's October 15th, October 20th. It's a long season. And that's why it can get so tall with so much tonnage.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I was just saying, we should show some photos and go over this as well. Okay, let's start with these. This will take us a step back. All right. So that here is an older photo of some kids. Yeah. And that's you standing right in the middle?
I'm the shortest one there. Yeah, I was 4 years old, and they were taking me to school way back then.
And so where did you grow up?
That's in central Missouri.
Central Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Could you switch to the next one, please, Liz? All right, so
yeah.
So you have a history. You, mm-hmm. I guess you went into the energy and into like gas and diesel, but field. But
yeah.
Here there's some serious plants.
Well, that's some pretty good corn there. I always loved farming. I thought I would have loved to have been able to stay on the farm, but it just doesn't pay. So ultimately, I got a decent education and. Traded corn and beans for a long time, always in agriculture. And then from corn and beans, I started trading gasoline diesel fuel.
Can you please switch to the next, Liz? So these are some great photos. That's who doing, is that seed?
I'm pouring soybeans in a planter. Now, that's back in the 50s, somewhere in there. It's a little four-row corn planter there behind a Minneapolis Moline, and that's the way you did it back then.
Right. So you really have that the experience of farming. You know how to grow. And is grass one of the harder ones to grow? Is it?
No. Once this gets started, it's quite easy. It is a little trouble to get it started because of weeds. You got to make sure you keep the weeds down. But
are there? Well, I guess has Monsanto come in and said, well, we'll produce one that's resistant to herbicide. Then you just spray the field with herbicide.
Actually, Monsanto is somewhat behind the curve on this one. They are trying to develop a seed for miscanthus because it would make it a lot easier to plant. But seeds are invasive. And this, what we plant is non-invasive.
Can we switch to the next series? Liz?
Wow. Wheat harvest. I always enjoyed cutting wheat down. It's really nice.
But that's short wheat. That's like 3 feet tall. Let's go to the next one.
That's
okay. So here is this taken? So you really are. This is beware of Amish crossing with their buggies.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool. This is Nashtabula. I can see the snow. Can we go to the next series? Because the next series will actually have some examples of some of the equipment.
I have to find that. Those ones might have been the ones I wasn't able to download. FitBlaster. So I'll quickly take a look for those and see if maybe they can upload this time.
Actually, if you could go to aloterraenergy.com. There's some really good shots on the website. We'll pull those up if we can. This is an incredible story in that, on the one part, well, it's not, I guess the way I'm trying to say it is this is a real account. And one of the things I really wanted to do is, tie in the concepts of you know, where biofuels are going. And, you know, there's that the whole heavily genetically engineered way, but there's a simple way of just, you know, traditional farming using you know, current technologies to produce a biomass that's just ready to go. And, you know, this is a firsthand account. This is a true firsthand account. So very, very appropriate for Futures in Biotech. And I really appreciate you guys coming in to share the story.
Mark, let me throw something in there. You know, the show Futures in Biotech, it is kind of funny because what we're really doing is using technology that's you know, 50, 60 years old in terms of our planters and just the farming techniques. You know, because this is not a typical row crop. So here we are using old technology to really solve a current problem. And it's certainly not rocket science. You know, our base case is let's just make some biomass and, you know, get rid of some carbon and help replace some traditional petroleum fuels. Simple as that. And there's a lot more complicated things that we know we can do in the near future here. But this is a pretty basic operation.
You know, I'm kind of smiling here because I know you guys are highly, highly educated and, you know, a lot of years in school, and your hands must be nice and soft when you go out and farm and do a hard day's work, quote unquote. You guys are really doing it. You all have jobs. I mean, I guess this is your job, but you have to grow the grass, harvest the grass, demonstrate. Is your model right now a test model, or is it generating, is it going to take a couple of years before you can start selling the product of pre-transformed Mithkanthus? Are you guys developing a pipeline for transformation of the Mithkanthus into like fuel pellets or cellulose? What's the next step? What are your plans at Alloterra?
We make pellets currently at our farm, and it's on a small scale. But those same machines can be scaled up into an offsite facility rather quickly to make just simple pellets. Again, there's nothing fancy about that. This model works today. It works in part because we are part of the Biomass Crop Assistance Program, which has sort of given us a boost for 2012, and it's going to allow us to plant about 20,000 acres in four different areas of the country, the one in Ohio that we've been talking about, two in Missouri, one in northeast Arkansas. Those 20,000 acres will mature in 2 to 3 years. And once those mature, we're going to have about 12 tons an acre. So what is that, 240,000 tons of biomass. It's not a huge quantity, but it's certainly quite a bit, and you know, enough to make a pretty significant difference. From there, this becomes self-sustaining. You know, we've made the planting of Mithkanthus cheap enough to where we can go in and use some of this marginal ground to plant more without any kind of government assistance or anything like that. And you know, from there, it's just a matter of continuing to grow. So this is a revenue generating company today. We will be profitable in the first year of operations, and you know, expect to just grow from here.
I'm trying to do the back of the envelope calculation. 15.
Yeah, you know what? I think I got that
million
wrong.
Million BTUs, 50 million BTUs times 240,000 tons. So 20,000 acres times 12 tons per acre, 12, then times 15. A million BTUs. You're producing a lot of power, which is amazing. Farming, producing energy. This is a great story. You did it. You took an Amish farm. You transformed it to address the solutions of the 21st century. And it seems like it's a fun place to be. So I'll thank you guys for coming on and telling the story and sharing what it's like to be a biofuels farmer. This is a pretty fantastic story. Thanks again. Our guests are John Griswold, President and CEO of Alloterra Energy. Matthew Griswold, who's a Chief Financial Officer. And we have Mark Griswold, who's a Principal with Alloterra Energy. Thank you guys for coming on. Any final words? You guys, we got it pretty much well covered.
No, we appreciate that you've given us an opportunity to tell this story, because it needs to be shared with most of the people in this country we particularly are going to try and make a difference.
Well, I certainly think you will. And I look at those clear cuts in northern Quebec and, you know, that coal burning plant with the chimney that's always burning. And, you know, it's really neat to think that you can fuel your house or heat your house all winter long in a carbon negative way. Right. And helping create local jobs. So if Alloterra takes off in Ohio, mm-hmm. You could create thousands of jobs. Right.
Oh, it's already been projected that we'll create somewhere around 1,200 jobs in Ashtabula County, and but it's desperately needing.
All right. So you are doing everybody some good here. So I really appreciate you guys coming on. This is really great. I'd also like to thank Liz Romero for handling the board stay, the recordings of audio and video, and the streaming. I'd like to thank our chief twit, Leo Laporte, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California, that make this possible. If you have any comments or suggestions, I can be reached at markmerc@twit.tv or on Twitter at Mark Pelletier, markpelletier. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Pelletier.